Are you okay? You well?
I'm very well, thank you. Yeah.
How was your week away?
I was in Disneyland Paris with the family. Having a young daughter means that at some point
Disney princess
on the bucket list. I mean, she's young, got a tween type age, but yeah, it was kind of, we'd been putting it off, and we know friends who had gone with their kids much younger, and the kids just don't remember it at all.
Ah, right.
And we really wanted to hang.
Kind of defeats the object of spending all that money.
Well, exactly. You know, it's an expensive trip, and it's really probably a once in a lifetime trip.
Yeah.
Because our teenage son probably won't be interested in doing that again. Although we went with friends of ours, and their teenage son, who's a couple of years older than ours, he still absolutely loved it. You know, there's a wide range of stuff to do there, but I do think it's a little bit pointless going with. I mean, it's lovely seeing the reaction of tiny kids going to Disney because they take everything in. You know, they're hugging Mickey Mouse and they assume Mickey Mouse is real.
Real,
you know,
yeah.
And it's lovely, but they don't remember any of it. So we really wanted to hold back as long as we could while she's still at an age where she still is quite into princesses and all that sort of thing. And, oh, man, it was amazing. Absolutely, yeah, breathtaking. Not the best of weather while we were away, but we had a couple of days of it. It was dry, and the last day it was just absolutely pelting it down, you know, and just everyone was just heading for wherever you could get shelter and stay warm because it was cold as well, you know. So,
oh man, that's miserable.
So, but that was fine. On the last day, we just stuck to doing gift shops and things like that. And
well, there's plenty of those to do, aren't there?
Oh lordy, lordy! But it's one of those places where, you know, You'll easily spend €4 on a can of pop. You know, it's not the cheapest of places to go, and you can plan it out in such a way that you can keep the costs down, and you can, like, you know, bring a certain amount from home if you've got enough room in your car and things, or go to local supermarkets and bring pack stuff. But if you are just going to go for a quick drink in the park or whatever, man, it's expensive. And the thing is, you don't notice as well. You just, like, there were seven of us. There was us and then the other family that we went with. And I just got a round of drinks in, and literally it was six cans of pop paid by credit card. And it wasn't till afterwards that I looked at the credit card and it was €25. And it was like €25 for six cans of pop. That's like, wow.
That's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, but I suppose you make these exceptions when you're on holiday.
Yes, yeah, and as you say, once a lifetime kind of thing, you don't really mind too much, do you?
It is. It's a bucket. It was a genuine bucket list thing, but it's good to be back. There's some very interesting things that we'll talk about later on, but just about how Disneyland's put together and all that side of things. Man, it's such an experience. But on that note, welcome back to the Measuring Up podcast, the UK's favourite commercial weekly joinery podcast. I'm Andy McClellan, and I run a YouTube channel, Godforth Handyman, in the northeast of England.
And I'm Peter Millard, and as well as running a virtual 10-minute workshop for YouTube, I also run a small but far from perfectly formed carpentry and cabinet making studio, business in the Garden Spot of West London. Now, every couple of weeks, we get together in our virtual podcasting studio to talk about the topics of the day, whatever takes our fancy, or whatever's been suggested by you, our fantastic listeners. But before we get into any of that, Andy Mack, welcome back. How have you been?
I've been very well. I've, as I say, just recovering. I'm so tired.
Mm.
It's one of those, because we're recording this just after the half term week. And as I say, I've been away for the half term with the family, and
yeah, we saw that on Instagram. Nice,
yeah,
good break.
It was, but exhausting. Jeez, I wish I'd had a step counter with us, because we must have been putting in, you know, 30,000 steps a day or something. It was, legs were just aching by the end of each day. But yeah, we're all good, and I'm raring to get back into it. Really, I've had a noticeable lag in getting content out, and I thought, well, should I get something uploaded ready for while I'm away, or should I just try and let the previous video breathe for a bit and see what happens? And at the minute, the previous video seems to be doing all right, but yeah. I do actually need to get some new stuff out.
Yeah.
What about yourself?
It's tricky, isn't it? Yeah, I'm well, thank you. I may be sounding a little different. I'm not stuffed up with the cold or anything. I'm just in another room. The decorating steamroller, the one room a month, rolls on and is not to be argued with. So rather than try and fight it, I've just decamped to another room, old school recording with my original little USB plug-in microphone on my laptop. So it might sound slightly different. But it's still the same me, I promise you. But yeah, well, thanks. Yeah, our half term's different to yours. In London, our half term wasn't last week, it was the week before.
When we were going through the tunnel, because we did the Channel Tunnel and for the first time, which was amazing. Have you done the tunnel before?
I've done it once. Back when I was a photographer, I went to one of the most stupid, we were talking about silly jobs. One of the silliest jobs I did was I went to Calais to a bonded warehouse to photograph bottles of booze for some duty-free shop.
Right.
And for some reason, they were different labels or whatever to the designs that we get in our shop. So they couldn't supply them to us. It was bonded, so it couldn't leave the country. So it actually made some sense to send me to Calais for the day to photograph. It's a long old day as well, just to photograph bottles of booze and perfume and stuff. That was crazy. A phenomenal earner made me an awful lot of money that one day, but because I was charging by the shot.
Yeah.
And so yeah, I made even back then, it was close to $5,000.
Wow.
For a day's work. Never did it again, unfortunately. But so I've been through the tunnel once. Well, there I'm back, obviously, so I guess twice. But fascinating experience to do it. Again, it was very slick and very polished then. There was none of the trouble we were having. Although, having said that, you hear stories of all the lorries getting searched and all that sort of stuff. As I was coming off the... the guy who was taking me to this bonded warehouse met me, and one of the security guys pulled me over and had all the gear out, was going through everything. What's this? What's that? The guy who was meeting me was tearing his hair out because he wasn't very happy about the whole situation because he'd actually tried to arrange it locally with some event photographer or somebody, and the pictures were just terrible. It's like somebody had sort of plonked a bottle down on a table and shot it with her phone. It was pretty, pretty poor. So he had his nose out of joint about the fact that I was there at all. So he was mightily hacked off when I was pulled to one side and had, the entire car pulled apart. Anyway, we got there, we got the job done, and I got home and I got paid. So yeah, all good.
Wow.
But yeah, it was then a very slick operation.
I mean, it's getting on now, the tunnel.
Yeah, I was going to say, well, this must be going back, 25 years. So
yeah.
Long time.
But as I say, it was our first time, and I was really impressed. I mean, there was a hold up on the way back because there was some sort of power outage at Calais or something.
Mm.
And so just everything was backed up for miles. And luckily, we were near the front of the queue, so we got through quite quickly.
Yeah.
But of course, it means that the trains can't go anywhere until they're fully loaded up. And they were sitting in their little passport control customs. It was the UK customs side on the Calais side where there was a power failure, and they literally had to do everything by hand, full manual checks.
Oh my God.
Like writing down all the passport details by hand and phoning it through to some other desk, and they were all operating off torchlight and all sorts. It was crazy.
What a waste of everybody's
unbelievable
time.
Well, you would think they would have some sort of backup systems for something like that as well. I mean, the whole of passport control was just at a standstill. And as I say, massive queues and lots of people getting quite irate about it and stuff. But it didn't. We got there early anyway. And what I quite liked about it, which I didn't realise, is that if you do turn up early and there's space on the previous train, it'll let you just go on the previous train.
You can jump on, yeah.
And it comes up on the little electronic booth when you're checking in. Do you want to go for your book train or do you want to go for an earlier one? I don't know if that's always the case, because I don't know if it's the same price no matter what time you go. Or
I don't know. It makes sense, though, doesn't it?
Oh, because absolutely.
it gets you out of the way.
Yeah.
They've got an empty slot on the train. It's not costing them anything.
Exactly.
You know, on the contrary, it's the ultimate imperishable goods, isn't it? Once the train's gone, they can't sell that slot, so why not let somebody who's already paid use it, and then it gets you out of the way and clears up space later on.
Yeah, and it would all have a knock-on effect of just bringing everything forward, which I would assume would be a good thing. And so, but because of the delays, we didn't get on the earlier one, even though we were in time for it, and we ended up just getting our allocated slot anyway, which was fine. But really impressive. Just, as I say, never done anything like that. I think when I was a kid, I might have done one of these trains through Austria that cut through the middle of a mountain, and it is like driving onto some sort of tin shack scaffolding kind of train thing. Bit of a different experience. But this was weird, because when you go on and the train starts moving and we were in the upper deck, you can't tell that you're moving, and because it moves off so smoothly and it's so quiet, you're just sitting there and you look out the window and it's like, oh, we're off,
we're moving.
bizarre. But we did the drive, obviously. We split the drive up, because obviously from Newcastle down to Kent's a bit of a
schlep
trek. So we did a night in a travel lodge down in Kent, and then did the Paris stretch on the following morning, which got us in kind of to the park by lunchtime.
Yes.
Gave us an afternoon in the park, and then gave us a couple more days of doing full days at the park. So it kind of gave us a half day to get our bearings and whatnot.
Nice.
But amazing place. Oh, yeah, what I was saying before about the half-term thing, when we checked in, they said, oh, yeah, it's split down there or something, that some areas have it the week before and some areas have it the week that we had it or something.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure how that works. I wish they would do that for all half terms, because it always does my head in that the February half term all seems to happen at the same time.
Yeah. Makes life difficult when you've got young kids.
It does.
Because everybody else is trying to do the same things and all the prices rise for that week or two.
It does. My wife works in a school, so we can only go away during the school holidays, and you're literally looking at, we're looking at going away skiing next year in the half term, which I've never done it in the actual half term break before. We've always gone and just taken our kids out of school because they've been young enough that it's not really had any impact.
Yeah.
And we thought, for this coming year, we're going to have to go in the half term week, because my wife works in a school and can't just take a week off the week before to go skiing. And the flights for the half-term week were 10 times more expensive.
Wow.
10 times more.
Just taking a mick.
Yeah, and it was just, forget it. So we'll knock it on the head until the kids get older. I think it's just, I'm not paying 10 times the price on flights. It's just an absolute pee take. Unless they split the half terms and start staggering things, which I don't understand why they don't do that, but anyway.
Well, wild guess, there's 10 times the price involved somewhere along the way.
Yeah.
Somebody's getting a bit of a kickback.
Yeah, you would think.
call me a cynic.
Yeah, you would think. I know in France it's zoned, I think. They've got like three different zones for holidays so that they don't all happen at the same time. Have we talked on this talked about this on a podcast before? I can't remember.
I think so. Can't remember. Podcast amnesia.
Yeah. Oh, it happens. So it was an amazing trip.
Mm.
Just got back on the weekend. Kids back to school today, because we're recording this on the Monday previous to when it's going out.
Yeah.
It's been such a frantic week of Disney, thousands and thousands of people, kids going mental. And now I'm in a house that's silent.
It is strange when they go. Obviously, been a while for us, but when they left,
quite spooky.
the whole house is eerily quiet. It's quite nice in a way, but there's that sort of slightly unnerving sense to it as well.
It is. It's quite spooky, but it's nice. I've got a lot to get on with, so I'm not complaining. But I tell you one thing that I feel I need to have a little whinge about is French roads.
Yeah.
I've always been a great advocate of French roads, because every time we've driven in France in the past, it's been through the day. And this time we were driving back in like late at night. It was absolutely chucking it down, really torrential rain.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Surely they can put some streetlights on like the A1 motorway. In fact, I was just saying yesterday there was some horrific crash on the A1 in France, so the French A1.
Yeah.
And I'm not surprised. There's no cat's eyes.
Really?
The line markings between the lanes are like completely worn away. There's no street lights. Honestly, I was driving with my headlight pressed up against the windscreen to try and see where we were.
Goodness me.
And it was just horrendous. There was bits of road where if you didn't have your full beam on, you just couldn't see where the road was going. And that, I thought it was terrible. As I say, I've only driven on French roads through the day, and through the day they all seemed great. Yeah. But do they not have cat's eyes in France? Or maybe it's just...
don't know.
For such a major stretch of road from Paris to Calais, you would think that they would have cat's eyes on the roads. Yeah. But there you go. There's a question for our listeners.
Well, yes, indeed. Yes, put it out to the hive mind and see what they can come up with.
Wait, what's the situation with cat's eyes on European roads? It was a real miss when it was, as I say, nighttime raining. You just couldn't see the lane markings. You couldn't see where the road was going. It was awful. So when we arrived at the tunnel, it was kind of felt the need to just catch my breath. It was quite nice to sit in the queue for the tunnel for a while, because it was like, whew, glad that was over with.
God, horrible.
But so what have you been up to?
I've been up to, well, I've been playing with real wood, trademark. I've been fumbling my way through my first hardwood project for about 44 or 45 years, I think. It was fun. I last time we spoke, I just bought a plane effect. I hadn't got it out of the box.
Yes.
Managed to get it out of the box. So we had a few niggles with a few things. Because of that, I was a bit late starting this. This is all to do with, I'm an honorary member of the Essex Makers Official group of people, which is an Instagram group. Maybe there's a Facebook component as well. We'll pop a link in the show notes. But so Essex Makers Official, it's a very loosely affiliated sort of group of people who just meet up once a month. Last Saturday of the month at the Hardwood Offcuts shop that I did a little video about a while back. And it just sort of came about as a general meetup. I'm an honorary member because I'm not from Essex. You don't have to be from Essex. You just got to be able to get there. And it's good fun. It's actually quite nice to have a chat to a group of like-minded people, completely disparate range of skills and abilities. A lot of hobbyists there, a few guys who are in the trade and wanted to come along, a few people had never heard of the Hardware Offcuts shop before. And it's just, it's a good place to meet up. And they started this thing called a Three Easy Pieces Challenge. It's quite a clever idea. You pay 15 quid, you get three, there's basically a pallet load of wood all bundled up. You fight everybody else for three pieces of whatever it is, and you make something out of it. And one of the things I wanted to do, one of the things I've been meaning to do for a long time, is make a nicer version of IKEA's Beckvum step stool.
Oh, fantastic.
And it happened that the stars aligned that I had these three lumps of hardwood. I had some sapele, some Morocco, and a piece of oak. And I think we talked about on the last show where I've been vaguely looking for a planer thicknesser for a while, and I bought this new cheap and cheerful one from Screwfix. And anyway, long story short, I didn't get to it till about sort of 3 o'clock on a Wednesday afternoon, and we were presenting our completed items on the Saturday, so I didn't have long to get this thrown together. So I got the planer thicknesser out of the box and got it set up and planing very quickly, actually, planes really nicely. And this is a basic, it's an Erbauer. There'll be more on this on my sort of main YouTube channel. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about it more in future as well, I'm sure. But it's the cheap, as far as I can tell, it's the cheapest 10-inch, so 250mm planer that you can buy. It cost me 220 quid, which is, not a lot of money. It's not, bargain basement sort of prices, but it's not an expensive tool by any stretch of the imagination for what it'll do. Mm-hmm. And it planed up these big lumps of wood really, really nicely. So anyway, had a few niggles with it on Thursday morning when I came to thickness, and that took most of the morning to resolve one way and another. Then I got it, everything sort of roughly cut to size, everything thickness through. I got this thing built on the Friday and presented on the Saturday, which was really interesting. It was a good exercise. It was interesting to do because, and again, it's something I want to talk about more on the main channel. I think I've talked about it briefly. I call it constructional design. You know, form is the design of how things look. Function is the design of how things work. I think there's another F word, fabrication, the design of how things are made, constructional design. You know, Do you butt a shelf? Or if you're making a carcass, a cabinet, do you put the shelf so that it rests on top of the sides, or do you butt it so that it goes into the side of the sides, so the side of the cabinet goes all the way from the top to the bottom? Sort of thing, just thinking that through. And I've got to say, I really admire I really admire IKEA's sense of design in this. And it's when you, because you may not like what they do, you may not like what they make, but you've got to admire the sense of design and the way things are made in terms of getting something strong together for the least possible effort and money. Now you can make things, you can nail things together better.
Yeah.
But it was really interesting. I'm mildly obsessed with this IKEA Beckvam step stool, Beckvam, apparently. The sort of a, I don't know what the Swedish equivalent is. It's a, in German, it's an umlaut, the two little dots over the A. So it's a long A, Beckvam. Which apparently Beckvam is Swedish for comfortable. So Clearly the Swedes are either just trolling us, or no Swedish designer has ever actually sat on one for any length of time. But it's a great design. These things were, I don't think I've ever worked in a house that hasn't had one tucked away in the kitchen somewhere. We've got two, I think. I've got bought a third. I've made a fourth. I put a little note out on Instagram to see if anybody else in the maker space had one. Matt Smith from Badger's Workshop has one as a shop stool, which he uses as a as a sawhorse sometimes, as a general stool. They're just really useful little things, and they've actually had a jump in price recently. You used to be able to buy them for £13,
right?
£13. You literally couldn't make them.
Do you know what the original ones are made of? Beech or something?
Very clever design. And when you start looking at them, they're very elegant, probably stretching it, but it's a nice looking design. It's not simple, it's not straight up and down. The sides are sort of canted in slightly at 5 degrees, so you've got to get a 5 degree bevel on the top and the feet. Again, very simple construction, two side frames joined together by four rails, with a low step and a top come seat with a handhold cut out in it, finger pull. And very simple, screws together. £13 for the plain beech, £14 if you want it painted. Which, of course, gave me a bit of a problem in that, what's the hook for the video? You can't make one. You couldn't buy £13 worth of wood and make one. You can't get £14 worth of my time to try and make one.
Well, the wood alone cost you £15.
But I did have £15 worth of hardwood from this three easy pieces challenge, so I thought I'd use that to make one. And it worked out really well. I was quite, again, first little project of this type that I've done literally for 40 odd years. Good fun to do. There may be some more to do. We'll see. But the planer thickness worked pretty well. Had some niggles with the thickness apart. And I know we talked a little bit in the last show about my problems with my Festool vacuum, where, you know, if you send it off to them for repair, they'll send it back to you in bits if you decide not to proceed with it. I spent a good 20-odd minutes on the phone to Screwfix customer services, because normally they have a Screwfix. I bought it from Screwfix. It's an Urbauer machine. And normally the customer service is pretty good. They have a technical support who generally can only read you what's on the manual kind of thing. But typically they'll have come across some of the other problems, and often they can help you out.
Yeah.
And this thing's not small. It's a 35 kilo machine when it's out of the box and assembled. And so I got through to this young woman on customer services, very happy to help. Yes, no problem. Bring it in. We'll exchange it for you. So, well, you know, on the technical side, is that what it was were when I converted it around to a thicknesser, when I tried to start it, it just wouldn't run. Rather, it would run, but only if I held in the power switch.
Okay.
So that seemed like a problem with the NVR. And there's a reset button alongside it. But, of course, the instructions are shockingly bad. They make IKEA instructions look good. It's all little pictures with arrows. So, you know, again, we understand why they do that, but it's because there's no translation costs. But, man, it doesn't help if you're trying to assemble this thing from scratch just using badly drawn little pictures. And, again, we've talked about this before, I'm sure. But the amount of time and money and effort that goes into the pretty packaging and the advertising versus the amount of time and effort that goes into giving you a manual to assemble the damn thing is just...
It's one of my pet hates. I get so annoyed about that. I mean, it was exactly the same with my compressor and, you know, £350 compressor or whatever it was. And the instructions that came with it are an absolute joke. I mean, it's literally like you've taken the Chinese instructions and then shoved them through Google Translate and just hoped for the best and released it without any proofreading.
Badly printed pictures, all in black and white, all really fuzzy and blurry. Just not good enough. And again, when you play at this end of the market, when you buy in the entry level, let's call it, that's when, and this is the first planar thicknesser I've owned, the first one I've used. You know, I don't typically play in that sort of space. And it's a time when, you know, people really need help because there's a certain amount of self-assembly required with this thing. And the instructions are so poor. Anyway, this thing wouldn't run. And there's a reset button on it alongside the NVR. And the instructions are so vague, it's just not clear whether you should press the reset button once, then press the start button. Do you press the reset button and hold it and press the start button? Do you press and hold both at the same time? Do you press and hold the reset and the stop button to reset it? I mean, when you start getting into the permutations, it's just ridiculous. Yeah. So I rang them up and they said, "No, no, our systems are down. We can't read you the manual. But if you take it back to any store, we'll exchange it for you, no question at all." So I said, "Well, okay, that's 35 kilos. I've just spent yesterday, little white lie, building the damn thing." "Oh, you've got to take it apart," they said. I said, "You've got to be kidding." "Oh, no," they said. "It doesn't have to be in the box, but you do have to take it apart because we don't have space in the warehouse for things that they're made for things that are made up."
Yeah.
Well, you know, taking it apart involves just taking the Bristol levers off the handles and the fence and the outfeed table and that sort of thing. You know, it's not particularly onerous. But then you're going to be left with a bag of bits and this big 34-kilo lump. You know, that's even worse for the tray counters, isn't it? It's got to be. Anyway, this went on for a while, and she went back to check with their manager twice, and that is apparently the official line from Screwfix.
That's crazy.
Yeah, so Screwfix's official policy on this is that they want the bits taken off. Doesn't have to be in the box, but for some reason they want the, so for this thing, it would have been just the Bristol levers and the fence and that sort of stuff and the outfeed on the thickness apart. And that seemed crazy to me. So anyway, I know a couple of people because of the channel. I know a couple of guys who've worked in Screwfix stores, and they say that the managers have much more discretion on this, and they will pretty much take anything back that you have, whether it's made up in bits or whatever else. And to a large extent, they would rather have the pieces all connected because it keeps it all together. So anyway. That aside, these silly little niggles, I can't fault the quality of the finish on the planing or the thicknessing. It's really, you know, very, very good. First time I've used it, so there's a little bit of, the thrill of something new, but it was fantastic. And on the thicknessing side, I was quite careful with regards to snipe because... I think we talked about this in the last show where planers and thicknesses, and I think I made a mistake on the planing and thicknessing where we talk about planing where the wood goes over the blade and thicknessing where the wood goes under the blade. And when with a planer thicknesser, the bed of the thicknesser moves up and down, whereas with a thicknesser, what our American friends might call a planer, the actual head, the planer blade moves down towards the bed. So with a benchtop or lunchbox thicknesser, it's fairly straightforward to keep the infeed and outfeed fairly consistent because it's always at whatever height the bed is, you know, 18 mil or whatever off the bench. Whereas with a planar thicknesser, when you're thicknessing, the height of that bed will vary because that's how you vary the thickness that you're getting. So I lashed up all kinds of little sustainer boxes and things to support the wood as it was going through. And I held it as it was coming out the other side and didn't get any snipe at all. It was really very impressive. Yeah.
Which is amazing for a 200 odd quid machine and not getting any snipe, because I've heard of 500 plus quid machines.
Yeah.
Benchtop machines where the snipe's quite bad. And
yeah, it's one of those machines that it looks like an awful lot of others. I think there's a Clark and a Fox and maybe a Shepak and a few others which look very similar.
Yeah.
And this is, and they are all up around the sort of 400 quid mark, apparently. This one's at 220, which is, you know, as I say, it's still 220 quid, but it's very reasonably priced for any kind of machine at this sort of level. And I've got to say, to get that kind of finish out of it is mighty impressive. So little niggles aside, and there were other things with these planers and thicknesses. I don't know if yours has this. There's a little micro switch that has to be depressed when you switch it from planer to thicknesser to make sure that the blade guard is in place.
Mine's got an on off switch. You can run it in any.
Not even an NVR. Yeah.
Well, no, it does have an NVR, but it's got no safety features on whatsoever. You could happily run it with the whole machine open, I'm sure, and it would continue to run.
Well, this thing has, I think, as a lot of the modern ones do, a little micro switch where there's a little pin, a little dingus that sticks out of the extractor housing, and that has to press a little micro switch. And that thing was snapped off when mine arrived. It was in the box rattling, or in the bag rattling around. I thought, ooh, that looks like it should be important. Put it to one side, not knowing anything about what it was. And then when I converted it from a planer to a thicknesser, that little pin has to go into a hole and depress a little switch. So I've managed to glue that back on quickly and make that function.
Is that what was causing the problem then?
No, that wasn't the actual issue. Whatever the issue was, it was resolved absolutely not by taking the side off and poking about the wires of the NVR.
Right.
So yeah. Anyway, it's working, and the two year.
Was it an obvious fault that wasn't? Sorry? Was it an obvious fault that
no,
wasn't?
I've literally no idea. I've no idea what happened or what I didn't do.
Didn't fix?
To be honest, I had a look just to see, and this is typical, you know, blokes tinkering, isn't it? I took it off to see what make and model the NVR was, to see if that could be easily replaced, because I'm sure that's the only problem with it.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's working. It worked. I got my stuff thicknessed, and it all went together very well. It was a really nice little project. And the wood was lovely. It was very nice to work with Sapele and Edigbo and Oak. People complain about the amount of mess that MDF makes. Dear me. Try and planing and thicknessing hardwoods.
Oh, it's colossal.
That's just unreal.
It's colossal.
I bought a big, you know, 55-litre dustbin type extractor to go with it, and that I fill that twice just doing these little bits and pieces.
It produces a huge amount, and I mean, on mine, I don't even have the dust extraction attachment for it, but I just let it fill the workshop up and I give the place a good sweep down afterwards, which it is. Sometimes I can kind of position the bin in such a way that it fires all the chips straight into the bin, but it doesn't always work like that. But it's amazing the amount of it. Like it always seems volume wise about 10 times bigger than the amount of wood that you've actually removed, which is
bizarre. Absolutely. I had three planks, and they're not big. They were probably about 1200 long. The Sapele was about 50 mil thick by 150 wide. The oak was wider but shorter, but only 30-odd mil thick. And the Edigbo was skinny. It's only 20 mil thick and badly bowed, so it ended up quite small, quite thin. But just running those through the thicknesser, the amount of chips that it generated was unreal.
Yeah.
Yeah, so yes.
Oh, well, I'm looking forward to watching that because I've got a whole load of YouTube to catch up on.
It was fun. It was fun to do anyway. An interesting little project to play with. There may be one or two others in future. Seems to be doing all right on YouTube. Interesting to play with a bit of hardwood instead of MDF too.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, well, as I say, I'm looking forward. I've got so much stuff to catch up on YouTube.
And that's a trouble with holidays, isn't it? Takes you away.
It is. And I say YouTube, I mainly watch a little bit of YouTube while having my lunch, you know, and so quickly catch up on 15 minutes of whatever pops up. And we're still doing it through our old PS3.
Right.
PlayStation 3, which is our kind of media hub in our living room, and it does the job, and it'll continue doing the job until it completely packs in. But the PlayStation interface on that's changed while we were away, and the watching people who you're subscribed to has gone even further down the list now. It's really interesting how, because it's always had like home, then subscriptions, then other stuff, but now subscriptions is bumped way down to the bottom thing. We've now got gaming and music and all sorts of other things have appeared.
All the things they're trying to push.
Yeah, subscriptions are, it'd be interesting to see where things go over the next couple of years, but they're certainly pushing away from the whole subscription model. Please do subscribe to our YouTubes because
please do, yes, indeed.
It's getting harder and harder to get subscriptions these days because just YouTube aren't pushing that model of watching YouTube anymore. They're really kind of the AI side of things of it, just recommending content to you, is getting so good that subscriptions are becoming more and more pointless, unfortunately, which... But it does make it harder for smaller channels where you do rely on subscriptions to get your initial kind of glut of viewing, if that makes sense.
Yes, absolutely. I find that if you happen to watch one video on YouTube, it's a bit like Amazon, you know, people have bought this, also bought... if you happen to watch one video from somebody on a particular type of topic... then you just get so many more of exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
And it's not always really appropriate.
No.
They make a fairly decent stab at it, but it's not always what you want to watch.
Yeah, and I've had horrific problems with comments in terms of just being able to reply to comments. Did you have that bug where... Oh, do you reply on your phone or do you do it through a computer?
I generally do on my phone because it's easier, yeah.
I always do replying through... I don't really use YouTube through my phone at all, very rarely. Mm. But so I'm normally sat at the desk typing away, replying to comments. And certainly through the normal web-based version of YouTube, you would be replying to the comment and it would you could only fit... two or three words in the reply box, and then these little scroll bars would start appearing. And it was like that for about a week, and it was like, oh, my, what a ridiculous bug to appear. And then it took so long for them to fix it. It seems to be all right now. But for about a week, I just couldn't reply to comments. And not unless you'd have to, like, type them into Notepad and then copy and paste them in, but then you can't
paste
see
them in. But I found, on the odd time that I've tried that, I found when I tried to paste them in, they'd only paste in the first... few words.
Right. Yeah, it's honestly there's some stuff on that side with the Creator Studio. It's a real mess at the minute, but and the whole instruction manuals thing, it reminded us of again while we were away, the whole driving abroad and sticking stickers on your headlights.
Oh yeah.
So that you don't blind people the beam deflectors. Do you have much experience of those?
No.
Basically, when you're driving abroad, you should be putting beam deflectors on your headlights so that when your headlights naturally point slightly to the left in the UK, so that it's not blinding.
As they should.
Yes,
the correct way.
The correct way. So you've got your right arm free for fighting people when you're passing them, jousting.
Yep.
And you're supposed to put these little stickers on your headlights. Well, anyway, could I find anywhere in the manual that, because I did a bit of research online and some people were saying, oh, well, with that particular type of headlight, you don't need them because it's like a projector type bulb or something. They're not xenon headlights, but I know a lot of the xenon headlights are self-adjusting and you can tell it via your control panel on the dash which way you want the headlights to point, and you tell it that you're driving abroad and it automatically points them the other way.
Yeah.
Ours doesn't have anything like that. But they do have projector-type bulbs where you can't see the bulb from... When you look at the car from the front, it just looks like a slightly opaque, like a dome. You can't see the physical bulb.
Right.
And what I'd read was, with those sort of bulbs, you don't need to use the stickers for some reason because of the way they're angled anyway.
Okay.
But I thought, well, surely it explains this in the manual for the car, and everything about the manual for this is an old Ford Fiesta that we've got. And great little car, drives lovely, but the manual, oh my, everything to do with changing bulbs, if anything goes wrong with it, the manual might as well just be, again, one of these kind of auto-translate things. It's so badly written. And I'm going through it and going through it, and, you know, you're trying to set off to go on holiday. It's like, I've no idea whether you need these stickers on your headlights, where to put them, because, again, it gives you instructions that you need to line up a certain dot with the front of the bulb, but you can't see the bulb because on ours it's got these funny domed ones. So it's like, well, where do you put them?
Opaque.
So in the end, all I did was I do have a control to alter the height of them. The height of the headlights. So I just turned that all the way down to the minimum so that they're pointing down as far as possible.
Yeah.
And I figured, well, that'll have to do. I can't work out where I'm supposed to put these stickers. So there's another one for the hive mind. Mark 7 Fiesta. Where do you put the stickers?
Exactly. Well, you tell me. Obviously, we've gone through changing the clocks recently as well. And most of the clocks in our house automatically change, thankfully. But some of them don't. And changing the clock in the van or the car, that's a minefield. Again, we've got a Ford Fiesta as well. We have a slightly newer one by the sounds of it. But, I mean, the manual for that radio is just baffling. It might as well be written by monkeys.
Yeah.
You know, just something as simple as changing the clock. Why? Well, first of all, you know, as a fairly new, fairly modern car, why doesn't it change itself, for God's sake?
Yeah.
Why doesn't it just do that?
Don't get me started, because the whole Bluetooth connectivity thing on ours is horrific.
What you mean? Ford Sync doesn't work very well. I'm shocked. Shocked to learn that.
I can't remember what it's called, because ours is 2012 or something, I think. So it's, 7 years old or something.
Yeah.
But it's quite a nice stereo. So it's got the whole Bluetooth Connect thing and all that. But, oh, man, if I'm ever likely to have a crash, it's because it's something to do with the Bluetooth just randomly disconnecting while you're driving. And it's like, you're like in the middle of listening to something. And it's just, why is it so bad? And I posted on Twitter the other day about Spotify Connect is amazing.
Oh, yeah. What is that? I've never heard of it.
Well, that's how Spotify connects to a PlayStation, so that you can stream from Spotify on your phone to the PlayStation, basically. And it uses a thing called Spotify Connect. So it's a bit like casting.
Yeah.
I don't know. You're all Apple, but I'm assuming it's a similar kind of casting methodology.
AirPlay, kind of, whatever.
AirPlay type thing, yeah. So basically, if I'm wanting to control Spotify on my PlayStation, it's much easier to do it via my phone because then I've got a keyboard and search for stuff and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And when you press the connect to your PlayStation button, it's literally boop, boop, connected, done, full control, no lag, instant playback. You know, you press pause, you go to the next track. It's instant, absolutely perfect. It is a model of how casting should work. You compare that to the likes of Chromecast and stuff, and Chromecast works, but it's very laggy, and the whole YouTube interface for casting is awful. I hate the casting controls on the YouTube app because it puts YouTube into this like weird player at the bottom of your screen where you can't get into the description of the video that's playing and stuff like that. So it's one of the reasons that I just use it through the PlayStation, and I give up on using it via the phone.
Yeah.
But yeah, the Spotify Connect thing's amazing. I'd love to know, you know, it's similar. It's one of those things like, what was it? GoPros are horrific for connectivity, like Bluetooth connectivity. If you want your phone to speak to your GoPro,
right?
It's a nightmare. I don't know if they've sorted it out on later versions, but on my old Hero 5 GoPro, the connectivity between the phone, if you want to use the screen on your phone as a screen for your GoPro, forget it. It's an awful experience. But then there's other devices, and it just works straight away. And it's like, why can't you get the developers from that company to sort out your Bluetooth connectivity and just make it work? You know, why? Yeah. It obviously, it's not a limitation of the technology. It's just something's not being written properly. There's something not being coded right. There's people not understanding the protocols properly. Because if the Spotify Connect side of things can work as well as it works, then there is no excuse. But yeah, how did we get onto that? Instruction manuals.
Instruction manuals, changing the clock in the van. We probably ought to do a little bit of follow-up before we leave.
Yeah.
We've been rambling for an hour or so already. We had a little bit from Nathan via our Patreon channel. You can, of course, support us on Patreon at patreon.com/ measuring up podcast. Patreon's done that. Now, Patreon says, we were talking about the funny stories from our handyman days. Nathan says that one of the shockingly funny ones that he had is where a client asked me to do extras whilst you're here kind of thing. They wanted a handrail up the stairs. He suggested Mopstick as the simplest solution in this case. And they shot off to Juicen's locally. And just as he was finishing off the alcove units, they literally came back with two actual broom handles instead of Mopstick pattern.
Oh, bless. Oh, I wonder if anyone's actually made a handrail out of broom handles. I bet it's been done somewhere.
I'm sure it's been done. I think you might have trouble fixing the brackets, but
I think so. Fantastic. And we've got a great comment as well. Well, we've got a couple of comments via Patreon, just about because we're on the new weekly show now. And if you're not aware, if you subscribe on Patreon, you can just listen all of the shows via our Patreon feed. So you don't need to keep switching backwards and forwards between the public feed and the Patreon feed. We're going to put everything on the Patreon feed, so you just get it all through one feed. And a couple of people were saying, could you mark which episode is Patreon only? And it would make it a lot easier, because otherwise you end up with a mismatch of some are Patreon and some aren't. And the easy way to do it is just unsubscribe from the public feed and just subscribe to the Patreon feed. And I've updated the little thumbnail avatar as well now, and that should say...
Yeah, we've changed the thumbnails to say Patreon.
Yeah, Patreon feed.
Patreon special.
So you should know which one you're listening to. The only trouble is, if you've already subscribed to the Patreon feed before the thumbnail was changed, then your podcast app has probably cached that thumbnail, in which case you're going to have to somehow clear out the cache of your podcast app and then resubscribe to the podcast to get it to pull down the new thumbnail. On Pocket Casts, I went into some option to, I can't remember, it was like clear cache or something like that. And it'll be different on every podcast app. But if you want to get that new thumbnail for the show, that's probably what you're going to have to do. But yes, we're gradually kind of learning how all this works ourselves. And give us time and we'll sort it out. And we'll sort out like all the episode titling, so it all looks fancy in your podcast app and stuff like that as well. And but yeah, the easier thing to do is just to subscribe. If you're a Patreon supporter, just subscribe to the Patreon feed. Ditch the other one you don't need anymore, because you'll get everything through the new one. But if you want to listen to old episodes, you will have to go on to the original public feed, because it's only from episode 32 33, whatever, that's going to be on everything. So, good stuff. What else did we have? We had a note. Oh, this is one for you, Peter, because I didn't understand it.
Yeah, we had a note from Glenn via email. Thanks, Glenn, for getting in touch, talking about the MFT table. And he's talking about the Dan Pattinson versus MFT. It says, Glenn says, hi, guys. Loving the new series and the topics covered. With regard to last week's talk about replacement MFT tops, He bought one recently for £20 from eBay, including postage. I'd love to know where that was from. Glenn, if you want to shoot us another email and put a link in there, maybe we can add that into the show notes as well. So Glenn says, in his humble opinion, it's not worth making one, apart from perhaps a custom size, maybe. He said the reason for the email is that, have either of us seen the Dan Pattinson MPT workbench? But he says, for weekend warriors, it's a great alternative to the MFT and very affordable. Particularly likes the edge holes for clamping vertically and would love to hear our thoughts are on it. I've never heard of it, I'm sorry, so I will have a look into that. We'll give you a quick opinion on that. There are many of these MFT-style tables and benches around. One of the things I talked about doing a version, a portable bench of my own, the bench I take out on my installs, has reached the end of its life about many years ago, to be honest, and it's about time to remake it. And I was thinking of doing one with a drop down rail, but the drop down rail does still seem to be a Festool patent, so I've had to rethink that. So we might have something else coming out in that line before too long, but I'll be interested to see what the Dan Pattinson MPT workbench is. And we'll have a chat about that next time, maybe.
Yeah, I had a quick Google search for it and I couldn't find it. So if you could include a link, if we haven't already found it by then, or drop us a note via Twitter or something, because, it would be interesting to have a look into that.
But yes, an MFT top for £20, including postage off eBay.
That's crazy. Surely the postage alone.
As Glenn says, it's just not worth making one.
No, not at all.
If it's a standard size.
Yeah, not at all. I mean, unless you're wanting like a really bespoke size or something like that, then I suppose. But even then, I would be tempted to maybe buy two or three of them and just butt them together. Well, I don't know. Would that cause any accuracy problems if you butted two or three together? Or
to make it work, the holes have to align. Otherwise, there's no point, is there?
But if you could get them aligned well enough somehow so that you could, because I'm just thinking for example, my assembly table's quite big. I would need almost an entire sheet of MDF to do that as a big MFT assembly table type thing. So I'd probably need two or three of the smaller ones. And whether or not I could make some sort of jig to make sure they're perfectly aligned, or there must be a way of doing it. But either way, it's just not worth it even attempting it for that sort of price. That's amazing.
Well, a length of extrusion and some of those fence dogs would do it, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, something like that.
A couple of pairs of those fence dogs, and then you could put them, you could get two of the fence dogs into each top and align them that way, because once they're in and tightened up against the extrusion,
and then fasten them down, and
they'd definitely be in line. So
That might do the job. So interesting, worth checking out.
Yeah, I'm thinking about changing the workshop around a bit. Actually, I haven't touched it since I threw it together 20 years ago. So it's about time the bench tops were changed anyway. My MFT needs a new top, so I'm thinking about making just changing things around a little bit, making a bigger assembly table. And getting the benches down a little bit lower, because they're all a little bit high at the minute, just because my ceiling height is so low. I often run out of space if I put something on the bench and work it up close to the ceiling. So I could do with getting the benches down a little bit.
I have many dents.
I'm very rarely sort of hand planing or anything. So
could you take the central partition out if you wanted, or...?
It's brick and it's holding up the upper three floors, so I
probably
don't
not.
Think they'd appreciate it somehow, no. Technically, I probably could, but I'd have to put a huge steel in there.
Yeah, not worth
it. And it wouldn't really open it up much, so no. Much easier to move, to be honest, than to try and do that.
Yeah. Oh, well, fair enough. I wasn't sure if it was just a partition wall or...
No, it's about 18 inches thick. About 400 mm thick, that wall. It's solid.
Yeah,
and the whole thing's made of engineering brick, because it used to be. Apparently they used to store fuel in there for the heating system.
Right.
So they had big diesel tanks in there. So it is literally built like a brick. Fuel stored. It's very solid. So it would take a lot of time and effort. Also, I'd have to clear the place. I'd have to empty the place. And if you're gonna do that, then you might as well put a level floater level floor in and all that. No, just much easier to move.
Yeah, not worth it. I mean, well, I'm still no further on the whole house thing.
Are you not?
The whole house sale, literally nothing.
Didn't like to ask.
Yeah, nothing happening at all. And at the moment, what we're considering doing is just taking it off the market and try again in spring, because I don't want to have the hassle of that hanging around Christmas and all that sort of thing. And what we'll probably do is maybe change agents. I don't know if it's an agent problem or whether it's a market or whether it's because it's a new build or what it's.
It could be so many things, couldn't it? That's the trouble.
Yeah. So I think either way, I think we've given it long enough to know that nothing's likely to happen this year. So I think probably the best bet for now is just to take it off the market for a bit, get Christmas out the road, shove it back on in spring, and then take it from there. We might even auction it. That might be an option.
Oh, really? Gosh.
Because auctions are... I'm currently auctioning my mother's property.
Oh, okay.
She's in a home and very old, and a house has been sitting empty for a long time, and we finally got all the court approval through to sell the house, so that it's not just...
You were running off when we finished the last episode, I think, to start dealing with that. You just had agreement to do that, hadn't you? Yeah.
Yeah, well, I literally dived on it that day and got it on the market and got everything sorted, got solicitors all done, and it's ready, and the auction will take place soon, and we'll see what happens. But the auction, the company who does the auctions was saying that auctions are moving much more away from just kind of dilapidated properties that are getting bought up by developers and all that sort of thing to a lot more just domestic sellers wanting to just have a quick sale, and they can't be bothered with the whole process of dealing through agents and having crazy amounts of viewings and just stuff dragging on forever. The nice thing about the auction process, because I've bought and sold at auction before, and the nice thing is that you generally exchange contracts on the day of the auction. So once you've put your bid in for that property, there's no going back. You exchange contracts on the day and you complete within 28 days. So from the day of the auction, you're going to have the money in your hand 28 days later. And it's just good, such a faster and more streamlined process than your normal standard way of selling a house in the UK. And he was saying, like, a lot of domestic sellers and buyers are now starting to understand the whole process, and they understand auctions a bit better, and probably because people are so used to things like eBay and stuff like that now. You know, it's not far...
I suppose so, yeah.
It's not far removed. And there are companies that do just online auctions. I mean, this is a physical one where you go to a monthly event and you literally hold up your placard thing with a number on and you bid. But there are plenty online auctions now for properties as well, and it cuts out so much of the... And you set a reserve price, you know.
Yes,
so
of course. Yeah.
You would set a reserve of what you would be selling it for anyway, so you've got nothing to lose. If your reserve is too high, you'll probably end up getting charged auction fees from...
And no sale.
But as long as the auction company's happy with the reserve that you're setting, generally, well, the way that it works for us is that it's the buyer who then pays all the fees.
Oh, okay.
So you have got zero estate agent fees. It's amazing.
Wow.
So it's a way, way more efficient way of doing stuff. So I think we might look into that next year. As I say, we've never done it for... We've bought kind of a dilapidated property through auction, like an ex-student rental years and years ago, and did a full renovation of it.
Yeah.
We've never tried it for just a normal domestic sale before, but I think we're open to that. So we shall see. It might get things moving. But as a result, it's just continued limbo with my workshop where I can't dismantle it. I can't really do... There's no point in doing anything to it in terms of upgrading anything. I can't make any decisions on what kit I'm keeping and what I need to sell, because we don't know where we'll be moving yet. And it's just limbo, property limbo.
Yeah, but, difficult, isn't it? difficult.
Anyway, well, we are well through. I didn't even get a chance to talk about my Disney stuff. Can we just round off by chatting a bit more about Disney?
Yes, of course.
Very quickly. The construction of Disney parks, or theme parks in general. I'm singling out Disney because I'm still quite excited about it.
Yeah, of course. I can tell that. You can take the Mickey Mouse ears off now.
And they're just my ears, Peter. Looking at a big theme park like that from a maker's perspective, and once you start to understand how everything's put together, man, there's so much of it that I just couldn't understand how they've put it together. It's just...
It's a magic kingdom, Andy. That's, you know.
It is. And
well, maybe it's witchcraft, I don't know.
But there was loads of it where it's like, well, that's obviously just a hollow plaster rock, because you can tell it's a man-made rock or whatever.
Yeah.
But you knock it and it's like, oh no, that's solid. That's solid concrete. You can tell it's like... And everything is... God, if you ever want to work out how to make things that look nice, but will stand the test of time.
Yes.
Go to a theme park.
Right.
Because everything has to be designed so that it has, so that it withstands hundreds of thousands of people every day.
Yeah.
Touching it and prodding it and, you know, kids hanging off it. And,
yeah.
So there's no way they could get away with plaster rocks, for example, which is the thing that goes through your mind. Oh, well, that's obviously, you knock it and you can tell it's hollow type thing. But it just wouldn't be hard-wearing enough. And I was fascinated with some of it, because some of it, you're going through these rides and the attention to detail, it's just breathtaking, absolutely breathtaking. And when I got back, I did a bit searching around it. And I don't know if you're aware, but Disney is all designed, the Disney theme parks are typically designed and put together by a team of people known as the Imagineers.
Yes.
And the Imagineers, the
imaginative engineers, you can see what they're doing there, can't you?
Yeah, and they are the team of architects and everyone who designs these theme parks. And they've got a YouTube channel.
No way!
And if you go to Walt Disney, we'll include a link in the show notes, Walt Disney Imagineering, and it's fascinating, but it's a really weird channel. It's only got like 5,000-ish subscribers or something. The videos have got like hardly any views, and it's almost like a training course for people who want to become Imagineers. All the videos are like labeled lesson 2.21.
Really?
How to handle crowd management. Lesson 3.27. You know, it's like, but nothing's in order.
They're bizarre.
It's like all the lessons are out of order, but it's literally, I know they're planning on doing massive expansion to all of the Disney theme parks of, that I can't remember the name of the head of Disney, but he's announced some giant, like, 2 billion euro expansion of Disneyland Paris, and I think all of the Disneylands around the world are getting massive investments,
right,
because they're making way more off the theme park side of things compared to what they're now making off the movie side of things.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's something put together to help train up new Imagineers or what.
Fascinating.
So I got immensely excited about that and started binge-watching all of these. And then guess what I've found? They've only got a podcast.
No way.
The Imagineer podcast. I haven't listened to it yet, so I can't vouch for what it's like, but they've got 50, 60 episodes of stuff. So I'm going to be binge-watching my way, my way through that.
Binge-listening.
And again, I'll include a link in the description, but I am so excited. That is going to be my podcast listening for the next God knows how long. But yeah, there you go.
Oh, epic. Well, good find. Good find. Well, we'll have to chase up on those, follow up on those, and see what they're like. Fantastic.
From a maker perspective, it's so interesting. You know, you see some of these massive, massive installations that they've done. You know, they've done a giant Star Wars one. I've forgotten what it's called, Galaxy's Edge or something like that. And it just looks like a section of the film put together. It's breathtaking, but
incredible.
It's worth looking into. Very, very entertaining.
Yeah, definitely.
Anyway, we best wrap it up for this week. And
we best wrap it up. And in order to do that, we need to thank a few people, don't we? All of our wonderful Patreon supporters, of course, generally, all of our fabulous listeners, but in particular, John T. Lynch, George Hadley, Nico Wilson, Darren Machiavelli, Duncan, Chris, Owen Bullock, Steve Avery, Phil Wilson, and Brendan from the Shades Workshop.
And a massive thank you as well to This'll Do, Kevin Miller, Stephen Broadbent, CJ, Jason Hook, Andy Sims, Simon Knightley, Tom Frost, Kevin Steer, and Steve at Fenricka Woodstuff. Thank you, everyone, for your support on Patreon. Remember, if you want to listen to the weekly show, all you need to do is support at a dollar above or on Patreon, and you can subscribe to the new weekly show via that. If you want a chance of having your name read out on the show, you can support at $3 or above. And thank you to everyone new who's come on Patreon as well. We've had a nice little influx of new supporters on Patreon. You're all very welcome, and it's always interesting to have a chat with you over on Patreon as well via the comments and whatnot.
Yeah, terrific. Don't forget, you can post feedback to us at @measuringuppc on the Twitter, at @measuringuppodcast on Instagram, or email us via the contact form, contact@measuringuppodcast.com. We'll always reach us. Andy, where can people find you?
You can find me, Gosforth Handyman, on Instagram, Gosforth Handyman on YouTube, and Gosforth Andy on Twitter. And where can we find you, Peter?
I am at 10 Minute Workshop on Instagram, at 10 Minute Shop on Twitter, or 10 Minute Workshop on YouTube. As always, thank you so much for joining us today. Always a pleasure to have had the pleasure of your company, Andy. Great show. Thanks so much. And we'll say goodbye for now.
See you next week.